Good evening, everyone. Welcome. It's delightful to be here with all of you. I know some of you, and there's a lot of new faces here. This is part of this talk tonight is the fourth talk in a series of five on the five spiritual faculties that are being given here at the IMC. I would just like to get an idea. Are you following this as a course, or are you just here as a regular Thursday night type of thing? How many are following this whole course? Okay, great, 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 great. Well, the course is on the five spiritual faculties, and the sequence that is being followed here was the first one was given on confidence and faith. The second one on effort and energy. Last week was on mindfulness. Tonight the talk will be on concentration, and next week the final talk in the series will be given on discernment or wisdom. So the question becomes, what is concentration, and why is it one of the five spiritual faculties? Why is it considered a faculty, and what place does it have in the pantheon of lists that the Buddha loved to come up with? And as you might have picked up, I spent some time in a monastery in Burma where I was practicing strictly a concentration practice, a samatha practice. And the emphasis was so pronounced that it was practiced, at least in the beginning stages, to the exclusion of all other practices. So everything was put down in the service of concentration. Most people don't practice concentration at that kind of a level. I want to say that before I say anything, I'd like to get an idea of, again, how many people, I'm not going to ask you individually, but as a group, are any of you practicing concentration, or have any of you practiced concentration practices specifically? So most of you are new to this idea of a concentration practice. Okay. So there's different levels of concentration, obviously. And when the Buddha talked about right concentration as the eighth factor in the Eightfold Noble Path, he was actually talking about something that's known as a jhana practice, or a meditative absorption. So I want to talk about that at some point a little bit later, but I first want to just talk about concentration in a broader sense that's maybe a little bit more applicable to what we're all dealing with when we sit down and meditate. Because when we do the mindfulness practice that we've all learned here in the West, it generally starts out with a focus on bringing the attention to the breath arising and passing away at the belly or the chest or in the throat or wherever you feel it. And if one stays with that particular instruction, a kind of concentration will begin to develop. The concentration that you get sort of leads one into this place where you can begin to then notice what's arising and passing away in other areas of attention, for instance, sound or sensations or or that type of thing. So this is a type of concentration that happens. Mindfulness is tied directly to concentration, and concentration is tied directly to mindfulness. And they're both tied to effort. So effort and energy being one of the five spiritual faculties. So what happens as we meditate, or as we begin to meditate, we begin to notice the relationship between these things, and we begin to learn how to work with them. So for the purposes of this talk tonight, rather than talking about concentration as a Dharma talk, I'd rather talk about concentration as a personal experience from the point of view or the perspective of my own meditation or my own practice, because I think it's the most useful way to go into this. When I think about concentration, I wonder why I need to concentrate. I wonder what's the role of concentration in a spiritual practice. I know what the role of concentration is in my daily life. I know that I need to be able to concentrate on what I'm reading. I need to be able to concentrate when I'm driving. I need to be able to concentrate when I'm doing, you know, the things that I do in my normal everyday life. But that's not the kind of concentration that we're talking about here. We're talking about a meditative concentration. So I asked myself, how is this concentration that I'm trying to develop and cultivate in my meditation, what place does it have in my life? Is it of any use in my life at all? And can I actually do this? So the answer I discovered over a period of years of practicing concentration is yes, it definitely does have a place in my life, and it definitely does. There is a way to integrate the practices of meditation, of a concentration meditation, into your larger spiritual practice as well as into your life, because concentration, unlike the mindfulness practice, requires a little bit more effort on the front end. And it's not so commonly taught here in the West, because there's a tendency, or there could be a tendency, there seems to be at least, in a little bit of fear amongst Western Dharma teachers, that if people are taught the concentration technique, the samatha meditation, that there will be a leaning and a striving towards, you know, honing in on your object, and that it'll be distracting in the long run. So that may or may not be true. I found that certain people are just drawn to concentration practice. I'm one of those people. And I can't ignore that attraction towards this particular practice. And I can't do other practices for very long before I revert to the concentration practice. So in my experience, I have worked at Spirit Rock for a number of years now. I'm the retreats program manager out there. And I see literally hundreds of meditators come through there, maybe thousands of meditators come through there on a yearly basis. And more people come to me and ask me about concentration meditation, what it actually means, and where they can learn this practice. So I think that there's certainly an interest in this as a practice, and as I say, more and more people are drawn to it, and in my own experience, this is I can validate that. This is a validation of my own experience or my own attraction towards the practice. But when I started practicing, I didn't really have an understanding of what a samatha practice was or a concentration practice was. I was full of ideas, which are completely natural, I suppose. But my idea was more that concentration was really to just nail my attention onto an object, to hold it on the object to the exclusion of everything else, and to eliminate thinking and sensations and everything else, that this is what concentration was. And so really for years I tried to accomplish that, and you can imagine that I ended up with a big headache, to say the very least, and a lot of disappointment and a lot of suffering, because my mind thinks, most minds think, and I feel, and I have these things that I have to deal with, and eventually I came to have to accept that my ideas were getting in the way. My ideas about what concentration was really getting in the way. And then I actually wanted to do this so badly that I went to Burma and I ordained, and now I was a monk, right? So I was supposed to know how to do this. And it was a big time lesson in dukkha, 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 dukkha. But eventually what happened was that I began to, surrender these things, to lighten up, to open up a little bit, to investigate what it was that I was actually doing, not to be so rigid in my thinking. And so, I was raised as a young boy as Roman Catholic, not to be such a good altar boy type of thing. And I'm going to skip around a little bit, but I came to realize that concentration wasn't really something that I could make. I thought that I could make concentration, and I couldn't, and I still can't. In my experience, concentration is something that we come upon when we can get out of the way, when we can put our own ideas and expectations about what it is and about what the experience will be like aside, just completely abandon everything, leave it at the door, and open up to the possibility of complete surrender. So over time I learned that concentration wasn't this idea of holding my mind on this sentence or this paragraph in an unwavering way, that it was something more than that. And I kept getting hints of it and touching it and sort of, brushing up against it and having the experiences of a sense of growing tranquility and serenity and calmness, and then it would come and it would go, and I couldn't figure out exactly what was going on, except I knew that I was getting a little bit closer than I had been before. So in the process, I actually began to realize that meditation is built upon a foundation, and concentration, samadhi practice, is built upon a foundation of other than just the desire to sit down and be concentrated. Like the Vipassana practice, the Samatha practice is built on a foundation of morality and what's known in Pali as sila. So in those early days in Burma, I was sitting with my stuff. I didn't realize that I had to, like, come to terms with that and really, with resolve and determination, put it down, let it go, in order to actually begin to access these deeper states of concentration. So this is a little bit of a, this was a little bit of a surprise to me, and for anybody who in this room who desires to do concentration practice, I would tell you that it's part of your larger practice, and the cleaner you are, the emptier you are, the more likely you're going to be able to touch these states of concentration that will get progressively deeper and deeper and deeper until you actually begin to enter what is called access concentration. And I'll talk about that in another minute or two. So concentration has its place in the Buddhist lists. It certainly has its place in the Eightfold Noble Path, right concentration being, you know, the last of the factors or the qualities. And what the Buddha meant by right concentration was not the concentration that I've been talking about up to now. What the Buddha was referring to was these states of absorption where the mind is so collected that it becomes unified, and they're known as the jhana. And what happens when someone enters a jhana is that temporarily, it's just temporary, it's not permanent, but for the time that you're in this state, you're in a morally purified zone, so to speak. You're not making any kind of unwholesome karma at all for that period of time. I'm not sure whether you continue to make wholesome karma, but you're certainly not making any unwholesome karma when you're in that state. So these states are states of really profound purification. So when you can go into this state, you are free from the normal hindrances that affect us in our day-to-day life. And because of that, and the mind becomes so collected that you actually are in a very pure zone, so to speak, or this experience is so purified that it's quite exalted. And, you know, some of the early Western teachers were afraid to go to this place because, you know, there was this thought that people would get addicted to these states or hooked on these states. And, you know, these states are just not that easy to access. It's not like you can take a pill and just get there. It requires this sort of moving through your stuff. It requires perfecting the paramis in a way to get there. It's not quite as accessible as Vipassana. You have to really make a determined, you have to make a determination, almost like a vow, that you're going to, you know, you're going to do your best to keep your mind directed onto an object to the exclusion of whatever comes up. But it's not like you're trying to stop things. It's almost as though what you do is decide not to give your attention to what's coming up in the periphery. It's there, you know it's there, but you don't give your attention to it. You keep your attention on the object. So I'm talking to you right now, and my attention is on you, and when the car goes by me outside, I know it's going by me, but my attention is on you. Do you get the distinction? It's not so difficult. I tended to make a big deal about it so that maybe I'm a slow learner, but it took a long time to see that, you know, it's simple, it's not really easy, but it's really not so difficult. And people make a tremendously big deal about it. So if you do decide that, you know, you're going to pursue a practice of concentration, or you want to take concentration up as a practice, there are a number of objects that you can select to develop your concentration. The most common object, the one that the Buddha himself used, was the breath. And the reason that he used the breath, or I'm told, is that it's there all the time. We really don't have to think about it. You know, you might not have been aware that you've been breathing since you've been sitting here, but I assure you, you have been breathing. And if you choose to bring your attention to your breathing, you'll soon notice that what I'm saying is true. And if you try to do that, you'll notice that the mind will, sooner or later, and probably sooner for most of us, the mind will leave the breath, and then you'll be off your object. And then when you realize that you're off your object, you simply come back to your object. How many times have we heard this instruction? However, it's really important to see what's happening when you're experiencing that in your own meditation. Because when your mind leaves your object, and when you become aware that you've left your object, that's not concentration, that's mindfulness. And mindfulness knows what your object is. Your object is the breath. Mindfulness reminds you that that's what your object is. That's the only role of mindfulness. Period. That's it. Effort, balanced effort, right effort, effort that's not too much or too little, will bring you back to your object and help establish your attention on the object and help you to train your mind to rest on the object, or to sustain your attention on the object for longer and longer periods of time. So these three things work together. This is part of the meditation grouping of the Eightfold Noble Path. The wisdom factors are right view and right understanding. The morality or sila factors are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And then the meditation grouping is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. My teacher in Burma, the Venerable Pawak Sayadaw, said over and over and over again, this is all built on mindfulness. Without mindfulness, you'll never learn how to concentrate. So it's really important that when you're actually in your own meditation and you notice these things, you know what's actually at play so that you can use these things to support your meditation in a skillful way. So when mindfulness identifies the object and effort helps you come back to the object, then really you have to make an effort. You have to decide, do you want to, you know, are you really committed in some way? Are you committed to cultivating concentration? Because what you're doing is you're training your mind. And the mind that isn't trained, that you encounter when you first sit down, isn't always so easy to, it's not so willing to do what you want. So you do have to make a resolve. But when you do that, it becomes easier and easier and easier, and the effort becomes more and more effortless. It's kind of hard to explain. It's like you have to make the effort to do your part, but you can't effort in such a way that you're grabbing your object and hold. You have to sort of let it come to you. You have to be really respectful, really quiet, really open. It was interesting in the monastery. Women, the nuns and the lay women from the village, seemed to get this practice a little bit faster than the monks and the laymen. You know, I can't say for sure why that happened, but there's something about being more receptive, being less needing to drive it, you see. So, but that's one of the things that you encounter when you sit down to do the samatha practice. So what I would say here, I just want to watch my time, what I would say here is that in the beginning, what you're trying to do is you're trying to find out how to actually get to a place where you can find your way in, so to speak. And people will do that in different ways. There's certain things that everybody has to do. You know, you have to pick an object, and you have to make a resolve to be with your object. You have to be interested in enough in your own meditation to find out what's going on when you're meditating. And then you have to learn how to be skillful and, you know, do this yourself, because, you know, you can't really read a recipe and think that it's going to happen. You can read the recipe, but you can get a little bit confused by that. So what I had to do is what I'm suggesting you all probably will have to do or have already done, and that is that you will find ways within the context of the instructions that you receive that will work for you. And I tried every trick in the book, because I did and continue to do Anapanasati breath meditation. So, you know, I would try holding my breath until I could, if I can't follow my breath when I'm breathing, I'll hold my breath until I need to breathe, and then I'll know what my breath is. And that worked for a sit or two. And, you know, I'll try making the breath my beloved and just fall in love with the breath, you know, because I liked that idea. And that's a lovely thing. And when it works, it's great. For me, it wasn't so much these tricks, but just somehow needing to get through my own layers and layers of expectations, of beliefs and opinions and positions about what the practice really was. See, and I wasn't even concentrated yet. Here I was in a Burmese monastery, and I could have done this in Marin. But it finally happened. I'm happy to say it finally does happen, and I began to make some headway. So I would like to now get a little bit more technical, and hope that I don't lose you or bore you. But I want to talk a little bit about the practice that I learned from my teacher in Burma, and the practice that I continue to do, which is a jhana practice, or this practice that will cultivate meditative absorptions. And when you do a practice like this, what you are asked to do by the teacher is to choose a meditation object. So in the monastery where I studied and practiced, most meditators, most monks or yogis, lay yogis, would be asked if they wanted to do anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And most of them would say yes. If they tried to do this practice and found that they weren't able to keep the mind there, keep the mind on their object for any period of time, and it got discouraged, the sayadaw or the teacher would allow them to do another meditation called four-element meditation, it's a completely different type of a meditation, and it would take you into an access concentration, but not into the full deeper jhanas. But he would allow you to start with this. So I started with anapanasati, and the way that anapanasati is taught in the samatha practice it's different than the way it's taught in the vipassana practice, the mahasi style vipassana practice that most of us know. And it is following the breath. It's choosing the breath as the object, but it's following the breath only at this place, or at the tip of the nose, or the base of the nostril, or at the upper lip. It's not following the breath at the belly, following the rising and falling of the belly, or feeling the sensations in the throat or in the chest. And there's a very specific reason for that, and that is that the meditator who's following the breath rising and falling is following a series of changing events, changing sensations. So the object of his meditation or her meditation is shifting almost from mind moment to mind moment to mind moment. And when you're doing that, this is a fine practice if you're doing vipassana. But if you're trying to cultivate concentration, you won't be able to build up the momentum to collect you this concentrated energy by having the mind move from object to object to object to object to object. And I've sat with many teachers in the West who will be teaching concentration and give the instruction to follow the breath rising and falling, rising and falling. So I just want to clarify that you will get a type of concentration, but to do this samatha practice or this jhana practice, this is what the teacher what my teacher taught, and he's renowned in the world as a great jhana master and a great meditation master. He's a very awakened being. So what he told me over and over and over again is that the mind has to rest on a single point and just not waver. You just come to a single point and stay there. So for the sake of this discussion tonight, I'm going to call this point the Anapana point right here. And I'm going to use this. This is where I choose. This is where my point is. Some people do it at the tip of the nose. Some people do it at the base of the nostril. Now, as your attention will shift from object to object, if you pick the base of the nostril, there's a tendency to notice the sensations of the breath being hot or cold or fast or slow or soft or hard or all of those things that we would notice in our Vipassana practice. But we don't want to do that. We don't want to follow the breath into our nostril. We don't want to follow the breath out. We don't want to know the beginning of the breath, the middle of the breath, and the end of the breath. At this point, all we want to do is rest at a single point and know the breath. Come to know the experience of breathing. So a friend of mine, a couple of friends of mine, I should say, have written a wonderful book about this whole practice. And I think I read it in their book. I could be wrong. Maybe I got it someplace else. But a nice analogy for what I'm describing here as a point is that if you had a straw, you see, the tip of the straw where the air comes out, if you were blowing in and out, it's the tip that where you hold your attention. And all you're doing is knowing the breath as it passes that point. As it comes back through that point, you don't follow it. You just stop at that point. And when the breath comes through, you know breath. And when the breath comes back, you know breath. That's all there is to it. And it's kind of knowing breath by sensation, but it's a little bit more subtle than that, I think. It's more like you know the energy of breath. You know breath energetically. Does that make sense? Is that clear? You can feel breath as a sensation, but if you close your eyes and you think about breathing, it's almost like you feel the energy of breathing. And that's what you know at that point. And basically, if you're able to apply your mind, apply your attention at that point on the breath, on just knowing the breath, and rest there for as long as you can until the mind leaves, then you come back, the mind leaves, and then you come back, and this might go on for minutes or hours or sits or days in a retreat. You just come back. And this concentration will develop sooner or later depending on the yogi and depending on the level of morality and sila that's established when you come to it. Some people practice this for years. I shouldn't say this, but I will because it's true. They practice it for years and they never really get very deeply concentrated. But the act of practicing is such an act of purification that, you know, I love, Gil gives this example of, you know, a drop of water going into a bathtub. Sooner or later, the tub gets filled with water. And it's the very same thing with this concentration practice. Other people sit down and within a very short period of time, they've got meditative light, they are absorbed into jhana, and you have to figure what's going on here. Something special is going on. And the way that it was explained to me in Burma was that people who have cultivated their paramis in previous lives, or in this life, who have cultivated their paramis to this level, will sometimes access these states quickly. But they also are quick to remind you that it doesn't make any difference whether you access the state quickly or not. As long as you're working towards it, you will access it. And that's all there is to it. So if you're at all inclined, I want to encourage you and tell you that from my own experience, hard work pays off, and don't get discouraged. So returning now to this anapana spot, the instruction is to stay with the breath as long as you can. So we've now had a mind that's applied itself to your object. Okay, this is actually one of the jhanic factors. It's called vitaka, and it's the application of attention to your object. So you're applying your mind here, and when you can stay with it without drifting away for longer and longer periods, you begin to cultivate this second jhanic factor, which is known as vichara. And vichara is basically sustained attention on the object. So when these two factors become stronger and stronger, when one is practicing anapanasati, one can sometimes begin to experience a meditative light. And this is a light that will appear in the mind's eye. It's a mental projection, and it's called animitta, and it's a sign of concentration. That's all it is. It's a mental projection. It's a sign. This nimitta is really marvelous. It's remarkable, and it really doesn't come all that easily. And it can be distracting because it can pull your attention off your object, which is the breath. And when it does that, one can dissipate whatever concentration energy that they have begun to develop. So you want to be careful, if this light begins to appear, to stay with your object, stay with your object, stay with your object. The object is the breath. That's all you have to do. You see, when these other things come up, you simply choose not to pay any attention to them. You don't fight with them. You don't try to make friends with them. You don't do anything. You just choose to come back to your object. The more you do that, the less effort is required. You see? By the time the meditative light appears, it's almost like you're in a stream, sort of. Could be this kind of an experience. I might not be articulating it very well, but the light is something that will actually become the object of the absorption. It's not the breath that's the object of the absorption. It's the sign, the nimitta. So you're absorbing into this unified mind, and the nimitta is a reflection a projection of this type of a mind state. And if you move your attention too quickly, the nimitta will not really develop fully. And so what you're instructed to do, what I was instructed to do, was to stay with the breath for as long as I possibly could stay with the breath until the breath and the light were seen as almost merging, as coming together in a way that there was, you sort of couldn't tell if it was a breath or if it was the light anymore. And people experience this in different ways. Some people are able to get nimitta very quickly, and they're able to establish, to develop a strong nimitta, and that's really what you need. So other people get glimpses of the nimitta, or it comes and it goes, and it's not really there yet. So what you want to do is basically just stay as long as you can with the object until you have the light actually take over, so to speak. And at that point, you shift your attention onto the nimitta. The nimitta is, as I said, the object of the absorption. And the absorption, when one goes into an actual jhana, into the first jhana, there are five jhanic factors that will appear. We have vitakka and vichara, applied application of attention, sustained application, or the sustained attention on your object. The next factor that shows up in the first jhana is something called piti. It's translated into English as joy. It's experienced sort of in the body, like what Christians call rapture. It can be waves and waves of this incredible happy feeling in the body. It's a very delightful, beautiful kind of a thing. The fourth jhanic factor is called sukha, and sukha is it's much more refined, and it's kind of like a mental happiness. It's a bliss of sorts, but it's more mental, but it's also felt in the body, almost like just perfect contentment and happiness. This is kind of the quality of sukha. And then the fifth quality is called ekagata, and this is a one-pointedness of attention. It's where the mind is totally collected and focused on a single, a single object. The object in this case being the nimitta, or the object of the absorption. So when you're in the jhana, the hindrances that normally affect us have fallen away. This is one of the reasons that a jhana is an act of purification. It's an experience of being purified. And the hindrances, as we're all too familiar with, are, I have them listed here because these jhanic factors are actually antidotes to each of the hindrances. So I don't want to leave anything out here. So the hindrances are, in this order, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. So sensual desire is basically just seeking sensual pleasures through our senses. Sight, sound, taste, touch, feeling, that type of thing. And the antidote to sensual desire when it comes up in our meditation, and it will, this is one of the real benefits of doing a samatha practice, because the moment you sit down, your stuff is going to come up. You know, you're going to see it all. And because you're trying to focus in the way that you are, you're going to see it in, you're going to have your nose rubbed in it, or at least I have my nose rubbed in it. The antidote to sensual desire is vitaka, or applied attention. What it does is it calms these desires, you know, the desire to move because I have a pain in my knee or my back or something like that. It just calms this down, you see. The next one is ill will, and this is basically aversion or negative thoughts or reactions to your own behavior or other people's behavior, or, you know, liking and disliking, that type of thing. This ill will is basically pacified through sustained attention on your object. So when you're able to cultivate these jhanic factors, and in the beginning you can actually work on cultivating the factors. You see, before you're actually concentrated and get the nimitta, you can actually be working on these things. It's the way that you become skillful in the process. So vichara will pacify ill will. The next one is sloth and torpor. So sloth is more like a sluggishness. You know, you just feel just sluggish. And torpor is akin to like if your mind just gets drowsy. So it's like a drowsy mind and a sluggish feeling in your body. Vichara is sustained attention. So it's the second jhanic factor, and that basically pacifies ill will. Piti, this joy, this feeling of energy and wonderful, rapturous feeling in your body, gets rid of this sloth and torpor. It's an antidote to sloth and torpor, and it makes so much sense when you think about it. Restlessness and remorse is the feeling of being unsettled and anxious and full of unresolved regrets, that type of thing. And restlessness, just not being settled, not wanting to sit down. The antidote to this one is sukha, or bliss. It literally, when you're feeling the sukha, it just eliminates, it obliterates restlessness. There's no room for restlessness when you're feeling this sukha. And doubt is, what's meant by doubt is a mistrust or a distrust of the teacher, the teachings, or your own ability to, you know, to meditate properly or effectively or to do the practice. And this is antidoted and overcome by one-pointedness of attention, ekagata. So what happens when you go in, when your concentration begins to settle down and get deeper and develop, you go into this state called access concentration. And the hindrances will begin to lessen and lessen, to become less and to have less and less of a hold on you, is what I'm trying to say, as the jhanic factors begin to increase. And they begin to fill your experience more and more. And in the beginning, you can actually try this. You can identify if you have a certain kind of a hindrance coming up to you know, call forth. May PT arise, you know, and see what happens, and try to work with it and just see what happens. So having said that, I'm just about out of time, and I know that we do like to have a few minutes for questions and answers. And but before I do that, I'm sorry that I have to stop right now because I'm really not finished. But before I do stop, I want to say that I have, as I said, some very close friends of mine who have recently written a book on this very topic, spelled out in great detail from having done the practice themselves. And the book is still in an unedited manuscript form, but it will be coming out soon. And this book is called Jhana's Advice from a Spiritual Friend. And my two friends, Stephen and Tina, over here, are in the audience. And this is the manuscript. They did an intensive meditation retreat with my teacher here in California in 2005, and were able to receive the instructions and basically go through the whole Samatha section of his course and actually begin the Vipassana section. So one of the things that I didn't say that I wanted to say earlier was that concentration practice traditionally is entered upon in service to Vipassana, in service to insight. So the reason one trains the mind and develops the mind is so that when it is turned to Vipassana, Vipassana is profoundly deep, and the direct experience of impermanence and anicca, dukkha, and anatta can happen, and the penetration of the Four Noble Truths. And so the purpose of meditating is to attain liberation, to attain nibbana, to attain freedom. And the way that it's historically and traditionally taught, the way the Buddha taught it, was to go through this path of meditative absorptions and then do the insight practice. So I want to just take a moment or two, because it is now 9 o'clock exactly. And if anyone has any questions, I'll take one or two questions. And then if anybody would like to stay afterwards, and I'll stay for a few minutes if anybody would like to talk about this further. So if there are any questions, I would be happy. Yes.
The state that you were talking about being in the light, could you identify that as astral projection? Would that be the same experience from surrender to letting go to the state of complete bliss, being outside of your body?
Astral projection?
Yeah, outside of your body.
No, it's a different type of a thing entirely. This is it's really doesn't have much to do with, at least at this point, the place that I'm talking to you, doesn't have much to do with any kind of siddhis or psychic powers. That comes to some people later in the practice, but not at this particular point, not at that stage. And that's certainly not encouraged. We're not encouraged to try to develop those things, because even the aspiration to develop that can be a distraction. And you're reminded over and over and over again, when you're in the monastery at least, that, you know, the goal of practice is to end suffering, and this is possibly a distraction towards that goal. The goal of practice is complete liberation. Okay. Any other questions?
The second thing after desire, the second
ill will.
Ill will, and yes. What was the antidote to that?
It's called vichara, or use the English word, applied attention.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah, thanks.
Sustained attention.
Oh, yeah. Now, there was one you had said was created sort of like a feeling of bliss. Which one was that again?
Bliss is sukha.
Oh, yeah, that's
sukha.
Oh, yeah.
And the and this antidotes restlessness and remorse.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, thanks very much. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I've found it very interesting to hear about all this. And are you saying that the book is going to be available, that the people have? Or?
Hopefully it will be available before too very long. You know, this was a big topic, and I didn't quite know how to approach it because when we talk about concentration here in the West, we can be talking about things other than meditative absorption. But in the context of a meditation practice, a spiritual practice, this is indeed what concentration means. And concentration used in this way is a state that's free of efforting. You know, a concentration for the application of science or mathematics or daily life, we may have to make an effort. And that's a legitimate way to concentrate. But for the purposes of what we're talking about tonight, it's really important to understand that concentration is, it becomes effortless. And the more you effort, the more unlikely it is you're going to be successful or that you're going to come upon that state. So you have to do your part, but it's a balance. You have to cultivate this correct effort. So I hope that one or two of you are inspired to meditate into to whatever levels of concentration you're moved to meditate to. And I would like to share the merit of our coming together tonight with for the benefit of all beings everywhere, and may all beings everywhere be free and happy. Thank you.